back in business. It's me, James A. Smith. It's the popular show. David, it's fantastic to see you again.
No, I could not tell you how excited I am to be back. It has been there. The world has been changing underneath our feet. We've seen forest fires covering Canada, blanketing the U.S., reminding them that we exist. We've seen the world change from Ukraine to China to everywhere in between. And here we are on the popular show, revisiting all those issues that seem to bubble up through the ether every time. And I couldn't be happier to be back with my good friend, James A. Smith. Thank you very much for having me back after a long hiatus. I feel a little bit like an estranged lover.
Well, the important word there is lover, David. Estranged or otherwise. Is everyone okay? Yours so and yours. I'm looking at those fires. That's a bit worrying.
The health crisis in the family. Some of 2020 has revisited us as a heads for everyone. It's been interesting. I guess there's new strains and new things. I mean, but there's no way to not catch it, I guess. So what are you gonna do? we've just been living our life, taking our vitamin D, drinking some juice, having some nice pho when we can make it.
I'm feeling extremely zen myself. I managed to get away for a night. I saw the sun go down last night.
Whoa.
Nude in a hot tub in the open air in Yorkshire.
Yeah.
Smoking a Cuban cigar.
Yeah.
I've re-leveled. I've reset and I'm ready for this. I want to say hello especially to all the patrons. All the Patreon supporters, those guys got some special stuff from us last month. We're dropping the uncut video of our COVID critical series, interviews with Jay Bhattacharya, Sunetra Gupta, Janine Yunus, and lots of other important people. The videos for those shows are just coming to patrons now. They're never getting unlocked. So you want to think about supporting us if you want to see that stuff. Remy Adekoya joined me to talk about his book, It's Not About Whiteness, It's About Wealth, which is going to kick off a very exciting cluster of interviews that we've got lined up for the next month, reassessing the racial reckoning of the last few years with some really exciting guests that I'm really pumped to reveal a little bit down the line. And we've had some good chats. It's all happening.
I think that's so exciting. I think that one of the things that I think we noticed particularly recently is that there's been sort of this realignment of left versus right around corporations and what corporations can do for them. You know, it's like, it's not what I can do for the corporations, what corporations can do for me. And essentially, you know, like starting about 3 or 4 years ago, maybe 5, you started to see these sort of pride floats with banks, right? I actually had participated in one, and I will post this for patrons, right? I was holding a Toronto Dominion Bank thing in DC, you know, like a very famous DC sort of thing, where I was at the launch with Sam Britton. If people know who Sam Britton is, they were dressed as a puppy play master, you know, at the Pride Parade. So I mean, it's very interesting to see that shift where when they worked at a bank, they said, "Hey, you look like a bear. Could you be in the Pride Parade for us?" And you know, think 5 years prior where they wouldn't hire gay people, and it just like the world has really changed in that way. And I've seen a lot of people reorient their whole politics around reaction to corporate sort of diversity and inclusion movements that really, to the people inside, probably don't have much to do with anything, right? You know, a lot of Anheuser-Busch is not unionized, right? Like, that's more of a concern to me than whether Dylan Mulvaney has their job next week, honestly. There's a lot of sorts of interesting issues in that way. So we're in this time where like we're seeing these realignments, and I think the popular show is that much more critical. And I encourage people who listen to the patreon.com/thepopularpod. We could use your support, especially in these times where David is getting COVID every other week. but thank you for your support. And James, please continue on.
Well, as Bertolt Brecht remarked, what is robbing a bank compared to attaching your sexual identity to one? I got to say, though, that it's been really fun to see your Ben Shapiro's, your Jordan Peterson's, your other sort of right-wing culture guys really going all in on protesting and boycotting brands because they've got pride memorabilia, pride t-shirts, etc., etc. It's just kind of strange to see them going through an experience that the left went through in recent decades, and there's going to be a kind of realization that they're, you know, if the left had to realize there's no such thing as ethical consumerism, the right is going to have to realize that there's no such thing as unethical consumerism. If we tried to virtue signal, they tried to vice signal, but ultimately neither of these things mean a hell of a lot. So basically
they feel bad because the only thing they agree upon is putting their employees through a meat grinder. It used to be that they said, like, okay, we are, you know, like sort of the state American stock, you know, we are the white shoe law firm, we're all these things. But the only thing that these people agree with corporations on, everyone's gotten down. It's actually the most Marxist thing I've ever seen in some ways, is that there are no values except for grinding your employees to the nub. That's the only value that any corporation has that is continued on. And it's very funny to watch. And the more stuff I see that's pro this or pro that, I'm like, great, good, great, whatever. But if I don't see labor standards increasing in accordance with that, I don't see it. Because, you know, when it comes down to it, I'm a materialist, I'm a socialist, that's what's going on here. You know, that's
it. Yeah, well, as we witness the right taking a cultural turn in a way that, those of us who take that materialist view on the left have found pretty cringe when our side did it, it's been striking to see the Brooklyn Museum go back 2018 style and hire Hannah Gadsby to curate their Picasso exhibit.
Oh, hello. I'm Hannah Gadsby, the Australian, the comedian, the screechy feminist TED-talking ruiner of man fun, and I'm here at the Brooklyn Museum. Nice. Why would they let a comedian loose in a world-renowned art institution? Great question. It's probably because I'm co-curating an exhibition about Pablo Picasso. That's right, the famous misogynist Picasso. I've changed. He's been dead for 50 years now. Womp womp. Nothing to do with me, I wasn't even born yet. And we thought it's about time we take a good look at him from another angle, a feminist angle, a comedic angle, fresh. Come check it out. It's problematic, get it? At the Brooklyn Museum now, through September 24th.
Pablomatic at the Brooklyn Museum, curated by Hannah Gadsby. Now, remind the listeners who that is. She was last seen resigning from comedy in a celebrated Netflix special. David, you're going to take the job of telling the listeners a little bit more.
You know, I would say this, that people may remember this. Oh, that's interesting. I think the smoke has finally got us.
Oh, wow. Over the course of this episode, decorated family is going to burn
down. I'm tempted down. To take people outside. It's unbelievable.
But this guy is not going to stop broadcasting.
It was perfectly clear out. Beautiful day. Mm-hmm. Sunshine. And now here, it gets foggy here. But now, just a whole blanket of fog and cover came over. It's really like the White Walkers are coming. Like, that's how it feels.
Well, you know, I always remember we were recording as January 6th was going on. We often seem to be on air when the big stuff is happening.
I just looked right out the window and I was like, oh my God.
I just hope it doesn't happen to you.
You'll see it. listeners, you'll see it behind me soon enough. Just the wind usually goes that way. But I'm sorry to be so taken, but it's sometimes things just happen. But so Hannah Gadsby is
Me Too comedy.
People refer to her as Nanette because she's an Australian comedian of complicated provenance, like not as popular in Australia as she is in the US, but like many sort of like Commonwealth properties, returns back to pollute, sort of the other colonies in ways that are relatively unpredictable. She had this Nanette series was in 2018 and felt like it was in 2018. You have to remember that was sort of the time of Me Too. It was about the reckoning of all sorts of male toxic behavior. If you had a penis and you were a man, because not all men have penises and not all people with penises are men, we have to understand that this was a time that it was bad for you if you were a cis white male in particular. And that accelerated and then decelerated after Joe Biden got elected. And I want to say that the turning point in that discussion was my wife, Heidi Matthews, who is more important than being my wife. She's a great writer. And she had said that Me Too was bad political policy. And I think Me Too is also bad art policy. And I think that this is what's happening, is that there was a time where you could check all the boxes. Right. We just talked about the pride stuff. We talked about BLM. We're talking about this stuff. You cannot check the boxes anymore because people are more woke in a different way than they were 2 or 3 years ago. They were queued up to understand, like, I need to know that this is good or that's bad. But people have been actually put through an unfortunate thing for these corporations, universities, institutions in general, is that they've mincemeated everyone's brains enough that these people actually know what refinement looks like. And they know this is bullshit. So talk a little bit more about what's going on with Pablomatic.
Yeah, so you walk around the Brooklyn gallery and you're seeing a bunch of Picasso works and also a possibly random collation of artworks by women that just happened to be in the Brooklyn collection and have been sort of strong-armed into this narrative. And the works are adorned with, I suppose, what you'd have to call snarky tweets as slogans positioned next to the paintings. It's basically quote-tweeting Picasso. That is what you're going to see. And that little trailer suggests that hasn't been a huge long-running history of feminist engagement, critique, and responses to Picasso, just as there has been to just about every.
And there's been Marxist critiques to Picasso as well.
Artists. Yes, indeed. and they tend to go deeper than this sort of snarky comment. It's almost as if what this exhibition is offering you is the ability to have the cultural cachet and cultural capital of being somebody who engages with Picasso, but not being so kind of behind the times as to approach it without this kind of absolute cynicism. It's I don't know, a couple of phrases spring to mind here. Andrea Long Chu, recent inaugural transgender winner of the Pulitzer Prize, she had a good phrase in her early writings in N+1, which I guess was back in 2018 as well. She referred to woke TV. That is the kind of spate of TV shows and movies. And I guess we could include the Nanette Netflix special in this as well, where you were watching a show, you were watching a comedy, and it felt like activism. Chu was quite sharp on this feeling political effect, and it was largely bad art, and it was largely fake politics. That political feeling didn't amount to a hell of a lot.
This is like this really reminds me of this sort of like millennial marketing you see on Instagram,
mm-hmm.
where you'll see like an advertisement for like a particular sheets company, right? And they're still, the sheets are still made in like, you know, Myanmar or, you know, somewhere where the, you know, there's children making the sheets, et cetera. But, you know, they're ethical because there's a certain kind of cotton or you know, Egyptian wool or whatever it is, right? And you could see that, and it's so interesting because I myself am a refugee to this mentality because I was too busy working in Washington, D.C., you know, where we were really pressed in our sort of domestic life, where you're like going out, doing all these things all the time. You went to the things, and basically you're like, I'll buy that thing. We're good. You know, like you got that sort of thing. You're like, you donated to a couple of charities, like donated to HRC, whatever. You're good. And you didn't think about it because you didn't have time, right? And what I think the pandemic wrought on people, especially people who are laid off or working from home, is this idea that like, you're like, actually, like that doesn't sound right to me, actually. And because you don't have a lot of other fulfilling things, you become a lot more critical of the things you're taking in casually. And I think that's where Nanette broke. And I think this is where this exhibit broke, because people are getting back into real life and they don't need to feel good all the time because they're living in cities with higher crime rates, right? Where they see that some, you know, we're going to talk about this more in the future, but like some of the things that were instituted post-racial reckoning were not helpful to Black people or white people or any kind of people. You know what I mean? We saw that Stop Asian Hate wasn't what people thought it was. There's a lot of things that people saw, and they got frustrated, and then they started being more critical because they realized, they're like, I'm not as busy as I was. Or if I'm busy, I realize I hate my job. Yeah. So who gives a shit, right? And then the third thing is they say, okay, if I hate my job and I'm not as busy as I used to be, I need to think about what my life is.
Yeah.
And I'm not dating like people used to. People are not having sex, like, which is crazy. Sex is good. You should be having sex. You know? All these things. And they're too poor to eat out anymore. And Uber Eats sucks now. Like, there's all these things. And then you have this Nanette exhibit. And people are like, why are we still doing this, man?
Yeah, absolutely right. It's the other phrase, the other sort of term I was going to throw in to help us understand this exhibit was the philosopher Robert Faller has referred to interpassivity in contemporary culture. It was for a long time roguish in the arts to speak of interactivity, the idea that nobody wants to just look at a boring old painting. You want to be, you know, sticking your hands in some Play-Doh or picking up an aerosol can as you go into the gallery and spraying stuff on the walls yourself.
Yeah.
Or you want to everything to be a sort of glorified computer game. And Faller said that actually, for all the talk of interactivity, what we're really dealing with much of the time is interpassivity, artworks and cultural artifacts that tell us how to react to them. We can't be trusted just to look at a structurally ambiguous an interesting work of art, such as indeed Picasso's art. We have to have our hand held. We have to be told what to feel and think and how to respond. It's a passive reaction. And that describes quite a lot of that woke TV sort of phenomenon. But it's brought to the boil, absolutely, in this Picasso exhibit, where you're brought in to look at the Picassos, and then you can't even be trusted to roll your eyes or to act sarcastic or to make a joke to the dates that you've brought to the exhibit anymore. You have to have Hannah Gadsby there to make the kind of, you know, arch cynical comment. The passivity has even got that far. And I think you're totally right that the overriding effect here is one of datedness. It's very striking that I haven't gone back and looked it up, but presumably the New York Times, like every liberal outlet, was very pro Nanette and was very impressed by this idea of
absolutely.
Like, oh, we got this new great idea. It's comedy, but it's not funny. It's political. It doesn't have jokes in it. It's going to make you feel fucked up and bad and make you really realize what's going on out there. But now,
I'm going to give an anecdote here. This is, because it's in
But the point is that the MIT is now dead against it. If you've lost them, then come on. Anyway, sorry.
I'm going to give an Adam Friedland anecdote here, actually. Mm-hmm.
He's always welcome on the show if he wishes.
Particular is that I had the opportunity to spend the night out with Adam Friedland not a few years ago. And I said, you know, like I talked to him, I said, listen, you're very funny. And we both had done comedy in DC as well as Stav and I think Nick Mullen as well. They're all Maryland guys. And at the same time, and those guys are like, I was garbage. Like I was good occasionally, but not a professional by any means. But we were talking about, you know, that time. And he said, you know, it's like, he said, you just wait. He said, comedy will get cool again. And I said, are you sure? And this is about the Nanette time. And he said, are you sure? And he said, oh, you just wait. You'll see. You'll see. Because he said, people want to be happy. And if comedy makes them feel like shit, they're not going to listen to it. They're not going to watch it. And I think people are tired of feeling like shit. And this is where we're at. They want to feel good, especially after 3 years of not seeing their family, their jobs being in like turmoil. Like I know I've been off for a while, so I'm a little keyed up, and I'm going to say that to listeners because I'm excited to talk to you. But what I'm saying is that, like, listen, it's been a hard 3 years for all of us, you know?
Yeah.
And it's been a hard 10 years for everybody. If you graduated from school in a neoliberal environment, blah, blah, blah. You don't need people lecturing you all the time. It's awful.
Yeah.
Have some fun.
Yeah. I mean, we've mentioned before that there are some funny kind of temporalities and timelines here where your average HR department is just catching up with the 2018 discourse. So this stuff is going to be in your life. Okay.
It's true.
I can't remember what guest it was, but I've described the dynamic where quite recently I was in some equality and diversity training, and all of the, it was all Robin DiAngelo. It was all sort of 2020 talking points being brought out. I was sort of making some sardonic remarks. And so,
yeah, Robin DiAngelo is a white woman.
Yeah, you know, needless to say,
she needs to sit back and let black women speak.
Yeah, well, It was one of those where people sort of spin around and say, hang on, I thought you were the left-wing one. Why are you against this? No, we're moving on there are different tectonic plates kind of sliding over each other in this discourse. But obviously someone at Brooklyn didn't get the memo that the libs are now more dirtbag than they were a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
They're not going to stand for this.
Yeah. No,
it's not going to work.
It's so interesting because I think there's like some sort of like canary in the coal mine aspect to this, where a lot of the people who are like sort of, I would say, like hyper normalized towards sort of like that left liberal axis, may often are in the most precarious positions, even at nonprofits, et cetera, because their youth, their position, and let's be honest, even their race and sexuality, like it doesn't help them even at good places. Like I just talked to a woman who was involved in a very feminist nonprofit who went on maternity leave, and they tried to like come back at her with like a worse position. She was like the director, and you're like, how does this happen in a feminist organization, right? But what you realize is that like these places are just as bad as corporations, right? So these people who had come up during the ascendancy of this, like the last 5 years, right? They believe the hardest and have fallen the hardest, right? Because like first, last hired, first fired. And I'm telling you, it is going to be really interesting what happens to those people and some of the like well-meaning like white guys who are like, you know, they're like, I didn't get the job or I, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And maybe they did or they didn't, but they, in their mind, they think they did because of the race. I mean, the backlash on this stuff is going to be crazy. And like, I believe in the goals. Like I want equity. I want equality, all these things. But like the ham-fisted approach that everyone took is so crazy. It's so crazy.
I mean, the people publicly denouncing friends and relatives, the people publicly signing up to the most you know, it's fine to have extreme political views, of course. Yeah. Comfortable with that, but they've got to be authentically yours, that you've got to have kind of worked them out and have attached yourself to them. If you're going around trouncing everyone and denouncing and cancelling people for not signing up to your program, then you've got to be pretty confident that it is a long-term one that you're going to be arguing for, as opposed to something that you're going to drop as soon as it's
going to help you.
Inopportune,
like, it's like they're like, you know, like these axes of like belief and patronage, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that because I come out of the Democratic Party, like I've been a Democrat, like I've always had socialist beliefs, I've always been redistributionist my whole life, but I come from Pennsylvania, it's sort of a very traditional like Democrat versus Republican state. I've always said like, okay, I have to be a Democrat because that's what you can be, that's what it is, right? But there was a time where the patronage corresponded properly with the belief.
Yeah.
When that broke, and that started to break all over, you got a situation where people are more likely to be radicalized because you need to take care of the people who are like taking care of you. And if you can't do that, you're going to find some people go way off the radar, man, like just way off the radar. And the fact that Democrats and Republicans, and I'm going to say Republicans as well, don't get this, because I'm starting to see this bubble up on the right now, where they're like, you know, the Democrats, they understand patronage. It's like, one, they don't. They don't. And I've DM'd a number of people I'm friendly with on the right. It's, listen, that's not actually true. You know, they don't take care of their own. It's pretty bad. And two, like, okay, that's okay too. But like, I actually think for a functioning country, like either there has to be like a little bit of corruption or a little bit of patronage. You cannot get rid of it and still have a country, because then it just becomes sort of like winner takes all bullshit. That's, you know.
Oh yeah, yeah. And anti-corruption. Sorry, Carl Popper. Anti-corruption is not a left-wing project. Just ask Lula about that. Just ask how the craze for anti-corruption went down in Brazil. Yeah. Of course, politics is structurally corrupt. Of course, on individual issues and with individual relationships and dynamics and personages, you want to intervene and stop it. But anti-corruption as such, if that is your end goal, that will always be used against the left first. That will always be used against, or never mind the left, that will always be used against the most marginal political position, as it were, the less wealthy political position.
Absolutely. If you hear, there's two terms that you should hear, and if you hear them in your country, you're about to get raped. That's gonna be civil society.
Yeah.
And good government. If you hear those two things about your country and the need to improve them, you're over. It's over for you.
So look, we agree that the Brooklyn Gallery is behind the curve with this retro 2018 Hannah Gadsby bullshit, and we have also sort of scoffed at the right's embracing of the power of the dollar against corporations like Bud Light and products like Bud Light and whatever you call them over there, supermarkets that have Pride t-shirts, etc. in there. This couldn't be further away from the radical promise actually of what was articulated in 2016 with the first Trump campaign. What Americans were demanding by voting for Trump. They weren't demanding this stupid what logos can you have on t-shirts bullshit. But we need to bring in a third strand of this kind of next stage of the relationship between celebrity and culture, and the discovery of cancel culture on the part of political tendencies other than the left.
The city of Manchester has a rich and vibrant history in which those of different faiths and backgrounds have lived together as well as stood together through difficult times and times of division. So I'm concerned to note that Roger Waters is due to play at the AO Arena in Manchester next month. Mr. Waters performed in Berlin this week and used the name of Anne Frank to Stoke Division, performed whilst dressed as an SS soldier, and used the Star of David on a giant pig to insinuate that Jewish people run the world, forcing the Jewish Representative Council of Greater Manchester to issue a statement condemning his divisive actions. Will the Leader of the House agree with me that concerts like this have no place in our society and shouldn't go ahead, and agree to a debate in government time on the record levels in anti-Jewish hatred in this country?
Okay. Yeah. Oh, President.
Well, I have to say I think that the whole House was very shocked at what the Honourable Gentleman has said. I shall make certain that the Home Office has heard the Honourable Gentleman's concerns today. And I think that this House has made great efforts, particularly in recent years, to ensure that the scourge of anti-Semitism is addressed and stamped out from our country. I shall certainly make sure that all relevant departments have heard the Honourable Gentleman's concerns today.
So that was Christian Wakeford, the Member of Parliament for Bury South, who was previously a Conservative MP, elected under Boris Johnson in 2019 and switched opportunistically to Keir Starmer's Labour Party. He's responded to by Penny Mordaunt, Conservative Cabinet Minister, who listeners might know ran for the leadership and the Prime Ministership last year. And they are in agreement, Labour and Tory, that Roger Waters of Pink Floyd should not be allowed to play concerts in Britain. That's where we're at, David. How does that look from across the sea?
I think for people who are not in the UK, I just want to narrow back down into where this is coming from. Essentially, this started in Berlin is where this started. That there was I'm talking to everyone like you can hear me and we're talking in a normal conversation, but in my head, I'm talking to you. So just know that. So when we talk, we're talking.
That's
so what I'm saying to you is, as you may remember, the movie The Wall, from the album The Wall.
From the 1970s,
before we had fascist, anti-fascist sort of alignments and who was who and what was what. Before, you know, when anti-Semitism was about, like, you actually hated Jews, not because of whatever else, you know. There was an album that was mocking fascism. And I think it, mocking what would have been the product of British fascism. I think, like, that's, to me, that seems like an interpretation. Maybe, James, you're actually from the Isles. You're a little different interpretation. I always thought that this was sort of like you know, something that was sort of getting against the BNP and sort of like what their vision for the world was and, you know, that sort of thing. I thought it was like very prescient and I would say very much an anti-fascist album. With some maybe anti-authoritarian tendencies that could have been seen as like anti-Soviet and rightfully so in some ways, but overall anti-fascist. Am I wrong?
It's bog standard left liberal,
boomer
anti-authoritarianism,
for
better and for worse.
Is
that a promising political project? I don't know. All I know is that is the politics of the best boomers. It's the politics of Jeremy Corbyn. It's the politics of Bernie Sanders. It's the politics of all of those boomer musicians who
and very helpful to
didn't
me
become right wing.
I gotta say, I have to say that was it was very funny for me because I remember both my parents were teachers. I think you have educators in your family. When I say teachers leave their kids alone, that was one of the famous like lines. I remember thinking, I was like, yeah, teachers, but not like teachers like my parents, right? I remember that being like a big thing, but I saw it as this sort of idea that there is institutional forces that people could buy into that are sort of beyond the control of the people even in acting in them. I thought it was like a pretty good political education in a very simple way.
And ever since then, Roger Waters has been performing in this sort of you know, it's like all those productions of Richard III, where there's kind of pseudo Nazi uniforms. Ian McKellen has played Richard III in that kind of aesthetic, and Roger Waters comes on, and I don't know, this isn't my kind of show. I can't really talk about boomer music given the amount of shows on Bob Dylan that I cram in to the popular show schedule. I do like that generation stuff. Never been a huge Pink Floyd guy, but you know, this is dramatic. This is a very popular kind of huge stage show kind of thing. They pioneered the sort of stuff that's parodied in Spinal Tap, of course, this kind of huge theatrical show. And Roger Waters has been dressing up as a sort of, you know, quasi SS officer and shooting a gun into the audience. And the obvious intended meaning of this is that authoritarianism and Nazis are bad. In Christian Wakeford's list of sins of Roger to Parliament, he mentions dressing in the SS uniform, which anyone who knows anything about that genre of music knows that Roger Waters does that. He mentions that
it was a simulated SS uniform.
Yeah, simulated. Yeah,
that's
worth noting. Yeah, because this is we're dealing with fake news.
In Germany
you can't wear it's very strict, stuff.
And yeah. You can't. And it's actually quite. It's funny because I'm not pronouncing that. I want to make that clear. But it's actually quite sad because I think a little bit of memorabilia would actually be helpful for people to understand the extent and the depth.
Problem. I mean, this is another issue. You know, but as World War II falls out of living memory, that is part of the context for the rise of the AfD, the neo-Nazi alternative for Deutschland, and it is also part of the very, very weak record of German liberals on Israel. That there is no space for any kind of anti-Zionism or pro-Palestinianism in German liberal society,
I've seen a quote, and this is one of the craziest quotes I've heard, is that essentially that the modern German state exists in part to support Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think that was one of the recent prime ministers that said that, and it was quite interesting because it's like, you know, they're not even the same continent. You know what I mean? It's very interesting. But I am not anti-Israel in that way, but I do think that people need to really understand like what's going on there. And but like Roger Waters is like the least of people's concerns, I think.
Yeah, Roger Waters is, you know, again, much like Corbyn, is a genial upper middle class English arty liberal. That is what he is, and the fact that counts as being radically left wing or some kind of crank only shows how authoritarian and how narrow the permitted range of our politics has become. You listen to Roger Waters' interview with Joe Rogan, and you're listening to the kind of guy who you just wish everyone had that person as their uncle. You don't need to buy into everything he says. You don't need to take his word on everything, because why would you? The point is, he's an artist, but he's an artist who, you know, is alive to the world and still in that charming boomer way believes that art can change the world. Here he is responding to Wakeford on stage.
And it says, Christian Wakeford MP, Labour MP for Bury South Manchester. I know who this bloke is. This is the bloke who stood up in Parliament last week and said that I'd been flying a pig with the Star of David on it whilst wearing my Nazi coat and desecrating the memory of Anne Frank. This fucking prick, right? Christian Wakeford MP. What a wanker. I am so glad I let live in Mary South. Fuck you, Christian. All right, that's enough with Christian Wakeford.
Roger Waters is playing some of the biggest venues in the country, so it is a little bit surreal to imagine this relatively normie rock boomer audience being treated to these monologues about how mistreated Roger Waters is being by these minor MPs in the country. But it is fully justified, because this came out today. Get a load of this. The Board of Deputies of British Jews has written to both the Conservative Party and the Labour Party, asking their view on this notorious anti-Semite, Roger Waters, being allowed to perform. And I mean, you expect the Conservative Party to do their duty by the Board of Deputies and to sort of condemn. But here's Keir Starmer, leader of the Labour Party, replying, "Thank you for bringing this to my attention. I found the examples listed in your letter of instances in which Roger Waters has clearly espoused anti-Semitic views to his audiences highly disturbing. He has done no such thing. There is no place for anti-Semitism anywhere." And he concludes that the shows should not be allowed to go ahead. So this is the prospective Labour Prime Minister, next Prime Minister of the country, is saying that Pink Floyd, you know, Roger Waters of Pink Floyd, shouldn't be allowed to perform in the O2 Arena on the basis of him being in so deep with this commitment to this anti-Semitism narrative. And yeah, I mean, when you've kicked out your predecessor leader, when you've kicked out Jeremy Corbyn on completely spurious grounds, then you're sort of committed, and there's nowhere you won't go. Roger Waters has to have his shows cancelled, apparently. This is just a crazy state of affairs. But the sitting mayor of the north of Tyne area of the UK has also been forbidden from standing as the Labour candidate for the role of mayor in the next elections, on the basis of him having shared a platform with Ken Loach, the celebrated social realist director. Get a load of this.
Sir Keir Starmer is coming under growing pressure to explain the decision to block the current North of Tyne mayor from the Labour Party's shortlist of preferred candidates for the election of the first North East mayor next May. Unite, the party's biggest union donor, warned of serious consequences of barring Jamie Driscoll from the list. Greater Manchester's Mayor Andy Burnham and his counterpart in Liverpool, Steve Rotherham, say the move does not seem democratic, transparent, or fair. The Labour Party said it would not comment on individual applications for the mayoral candidacy.
Jamie Driscoll is not allowed to stand as mayor, even though he's the current sitting mayor. Is there a precedent for that in American politics? Can you imagine the incumbent candidate not being allowed to run with the party ticket?
I would just say that it's actually quite the opposite, actually. That in the Deep South, they have people running who are anti-abortion, which is like a key tenet of the Democratic Party. Like, that's like a very important thing. Nancy Pelosi said 2 years ago, you know, when Roe v. Wade was on the docket, like it's on the docket, like people are being restricted abortions, that there's a distinct number of people who have been born into families that cannot support them because of these laws in the South. That's a fact. And in the Midwest, I don't want to be like, I'm a fan of people in the South, and they're only like 47% of them have very progressive views. And everybody, especially the men in the United States, say like, well, those people are terrible. Like, man, they're just outnumbered. They're not terrible. Right. You know, like, and most of the people there, they may or may not know what's going on, or they do and they're scared, whatever. It's complicated. But there is no precedent for that in the United States. And most of the time, with the exception, and we'll talk about Robert Kennedy Jr. later, which I'm very eager to discuss. They typically will put themselves on other tickets, right? You know, it's like, this is not the case, especially for an incumbent. an incumbent, you would say, hey, man, like, can we work with you on this or whatever? They're just the assumption that they're going to re-win that district or that town, the city, is so crazy. From like, I used to do like on the ground political operation, and you'd be like, okay, who's going to win here? And like, you would get really down to like some nuts and bolts stuff, and you didn't like it. Like, I'm an ideologue myself. Like, it's just like, of course. But you know, when I did that, I was a numbers guy. I said, you know, like, all right, who can win this? Who can win that? I prefer more Democrats than Republicans. Fact, right? The Labor Party doesn't seem to have any of those people. And like, they're like neither ideologues in the real sense, nor are they like numbers guys. And I don't get, I just, as an American political operative, I just don't get the whole scene.
Adam Langelben, National Secretary of the Jewish Labor Movement, said, if Mr. Driscoll, the mayor who is losing the candidacy, did attend our training, and we have no record that he did, it is clear that he didn't take much from it, as we state that platforming people with histories of controversial statements towards Jews is ill-advised. The mind boggles, and this is where I'm just so through this with this stuff. I spent the Corbyn years, you know, trying to, you know, be open-minded with this stuff. But this is an outrageous departure from any kind of political norm, nationally or internationally. This is an outrageous instance of McCarthyism.
Like, you're in charge of everybody you associate with. That's crazy. Yeah, and also, so if this person improves, so that in that statement, there's no room for improvement. There's no be like, now I'm an ultra-Zionist. Like, now I have a Benjamin Netanyahu t-shirt that I wear every day. I can't, you know, like, you're like, I'm keeping kosher even though I'm a Christian. There's no anything there. There's no room for improvement. That has no space in civil society. You cannot, you can't do that. You can't, because like, I remember, was it Shamima Begum, right? Like, we talked about the girl who came back, right?
Mm-hmm. From ISIS, yeah.
I found that as an American, like, quite, and like, America is like not a tolerant place, but like, I found that quite like crazy to me, because I'm like, this is a girl who was trafficked, she's trying to come back, she's like, she's good now, whatever, and there was no forgiveness. And I just think, I'm like, in a country where you have more colonial woes than anyone else, forgiveness should be part of your national character.
Yeah, well, we're going to a dark place, and
it's really whack.
The liberal left is driving us there, and so Keir Starmer will no doubt oversee it. I mean, I've got to say that, like, throughout the Corbyn years, a lot of us on the Corbyn left, while seeing the big picture that anti-Semitism accusations were being instrumentalized in a very tawdry way, quite apart from the fact that they were being used against my side. But I tried to approach that with some intellectual generosity and interest. And I was interested in the idea that, you know, okay, maybe there is a kind of language that we can agree upon for talking about Israel. Maybe there is a language that we can agree upon for talking about the history of whatever Jewish history, etc., that would be kind of congenial to all sides, and maybe it is true that there are ill-advised statements that people can make. But the fact that the cost of saying something not anti-Semitic, not inciting hate, but ill-advised, or rather platforming somebody who has said something a bit off, allegedly, is ill-advised, that the cost for that should be losing your job, that the cost for that should be losing your candidacy. This is outrageous. And frankly, I would put up with, you know, a complete free speech fundamentalism, I would rather have everyone allowed to say whatever slurs they want, quite frankly, than to have this sort of situation where this partial and patchy application of this kind of scolding is allowed to take place. It's hideous on its own terms. And if you're interested in either left politics or more broadly resisting this authoritarian creep, where concerts can be cancelled, where mayors can be kicked out of office, where people can lose their jobs on the basis of having associated with the wrong people who have said the wrong thing, you know, fuck it, man. This anti-Semitism Labour thing, if you were on the side that said, you know, Corbyn was anti-Semitic, therefore he's bad, you're on the goddamn wrong side of history with this, because never mind if you've got no interest in Israel-Palestine, never mind if you've got no interest in Jews whatsoever, this is the spearhead of a complete program of the collapse of the ability to say anything at all.
Yeah.
And it's fucked up.
Like, evil. When Keir Starmer says, hey, listen, I'm not for real nationalization, right? Like, every trip you take on that train is your fault.
Yeah.
Fact. Every trip you take on Richard Branson's train for more and less convenience is your fault. Every time you fly between places in the UK and there's not regulation, that's your fault, because you thought an imaginary anti-Semitism claim applied to Jeremy Corbyn. And that's a fact, because it doesn't matter about Jeremy Corbyn. And Jeremy Corbyn would say this, and I know he would say this. Bernie Sanders would say this. It's not about me, it's about us.
Yeah.
And the fact is if you're willing to get into a boutique belief about being inconvenienced or saddened or hurt about something that didn't even happen, then your boutique belief is preventing people of color in your country and poor people in your country from getting from here to there. You should have to wear a weighted vest every day, because you should have to put 50 pounds of extra weight on you that you have to carry on, and your boutique belief, that's what you carry, because that's what poor people in Surrey are carrying. That's what poor people in the Midlands are carrying when they can't get down to London for an appointment, for this or that. That's your fault.
That's David Slavik saying it.
You can blame it on me. Please, please talk at the contact at thepopularpod.com, and you can yell at me.
One guy who's not gonna get
I'm serious about
strong.
This. I gotta go back for 1 minute. Yeah, I see. I was like, Jeremy Corbyn is plus 20 what Bernie Sanders was, and I love Bernie Sanders. I love Bernie Sanders. Like, I've shaken his hand. I think I've given him a hug once. I love Bernie Sanders. I was asking on his campaign when there was only 3 people on his campaign, right?
I love that all your anecdotes involve you meeting and drinking and being offered jobs by the great and good of America. And
but what I'm saying
all,
is I love
all
this
my
guy.
Anecdotes involve me being naked and alone in Yorkshire.
Jeremy Corbyn, and you're like, you know what? Some people who write for the Times says he's anti-Semitic. Fuck off. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, it's true. But I mean, it's even beyond it's beyond Corbyn now. This is the model for free speech in Britain for the future, that anyone could be cut out of the public sphere at any time. And you know, it's very interesting how often we have kind of anti-woke people on the show or right-wingers on the show, and you can sort of, you could divide them into two columns. The ones that will extend that to the preeminent form of cancel culture that we have today, which is over the kind of partial and irregular application of accusations of anti-Semitism. That is the preeminent form that cancel culture takes. You could divide the right between those who will acknowledge that and those who will sort of get very cagey and say that, no, actually the Labour anti-Semitism crisis was real and those people should have been cancelled after all. One person who is refusing to have this model applied to them is RFK Jr. We spoke about his candidacy for the Democratic presidential candidacy next year with Doug Lane, and he continues to be an intriguing figure. Let's just drop this clip.
Mr. Kenny, a lot of people are confused about the tweet storm. I call it the tweet heard around the world. A couple of tweets were put up in support of Roger Waters and then taken down. Do you want to give us a little explanation of why they were taken down and also your stance on Israel and Palestine?
I tweeted that. I made the tweet applauding Roger Waters' courage in opposing the COVID mandates and the Ukraine war. I was unaware of his position on Israel. And when I learned that, I immediately took it down. My position of Israel is that I support Israel. I support, my family has a long relationship with Israel. I support its right to exist and its right to protect its security.
And the Palestinians?
And a humane outcome and a recognition ultimately of the aspirations of the Palestinian people is important for everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What do you make of it?
So, RFK Jr., we've discussed him as somebody with a highly conventional Democratic Party history. And of course, he's a Kennedy. He's the son of Bobby Kennedy, who sort of went awry when his environmentalism took him into anti-vax politics. And this is pre-COVID, so this is, you know, the normal vaccines that most people who are critical, as I certainly am, and we are to an extent, of the COVID vaccines.
I'm gonna intervene there.
Oh, he's saying
he was anti-thermicera.
Okay,
and so this is a very complicated issue, and I think that if you pinned him down, you had him in a corner, and he said, are you anti-vax? I don't think you'd be anti-vax. That's not his position. Thermicerol was a mercury substitute. It's like a mercury like analog of some sort that they would use to stabilize vaccines. It's not used everywhere there's vaccines. It's mostly used in the United States and Canada, I believe. And some people believe, and I'm not justifying or, like, I'm not, like, verifying his belief in this. I'm just telling you I'm getting it down to, like, the actual thing, molecule level, if you want, is that thermicerol caused things like sort of birth defects, like, not birth defects, but, like, health defects in early childhood, and including autism. Thermicerol was introduced, I believe, in the mid-80s. So that would correspond with a spike in autism. Both of my parents are developmental experts in childhood stuff, and they both work with special needs people. I asked them about this. I said, is this a thing? They said they think that it could be like environmental plus also like people actually being identified, right? So they're saying like, sure, there could be other factors that cause more things going on, but it also could just be the fact that they have better screening. So what he's saying is not actually anti-vax in the way that we think of anti-vax, like for like someone named Millennial Mindy for Trump or something. Like it's not, that's not his lane. His lane is more from like a public like interest lawyer who is interested in anti-pharma. Which is I buy into. He had a show called Ring of Fire with Sam Cedar, which makes him one degree of separation from us.
That's very interesting.
But I just want to clarify.
What does Sam say about him now?
Anti-vax like label is not really appropriate for him. Like now his later stuff, like I don't know as much. Like, but I can speak to that childhood vaccines to that.
Okay. I mean, he was involved in funding and backing various sort of, films promoting the connection between MMR, jabs, and autism after the Lancet had withdrawn the famous piece of research on it. I mean, this isn't disqualifying as far as I'm concerned. We've learned through COVID that just because there isn't positive research proving something that a lot of people think exists, that doesn't mean that it's not there. It can mean that the interest is not there in the scientific community, or the people just don't have, you know, the funding, the money isn't backing that kind of research. So who knows? This isn't something we're coming down on some side with. What is interesting is that it's a Democratic candidate, you know, which has become the party of science, the party of believe science, the party of unquestioning adherence to the pharmaceutical industry during the COVID period. That here is a Kennedy stepping into the ring. This should be exciting people in the Democratic Party, but you know, is really antithetical to one of their core beliefs at the present time. And the same goes for his extreme skepticism over Ukraine, sounding to us, of course, welcome cautionary note on the Zelensky fever and the, you know, complete anti-Russian propaganda, really, that has completely simplified the history of America, the history of NATO in the region, and shown a complete amnesia and refusal to report on that. So as far as I'm concerned, RFK Jr.'s intervention into the 2024 race is an unalloyed good. It's a brilliant thing, and I'm certainly not going to get sidetracked by worrying about whether his sort of health work is legitimate or not. He said himself that's not what he's running on. If all he's running on is avoiding a similar kind of regime of lockdowns and policing of discourse, if there is another pandemic, then I think he would be a better president than Trump or Biden in those circumstances.
I'll just be honest with you, like the sheer fact is with notable exceptions, and this is the darkest part of Washington, is that the people who fill cabinet positions, there's something called the plum book, and there's, I think it's 2,000 positions that have to be filled that are executive appointed positions. 2,000 of those positions, I would say 1,800 of them are going to be people who are already in, like that's like Biden people I know, you know, people you know, like people that are in Washington. Some of them Republicans, some of them Democrats. Like people are always saying, like, oh, Sam Brinton, right? We always, I hate that we bring up Sam Brinton also because I love them. They're a good person, right? You know, there's stuff going on, but they're a good person.
This
but,
is like, the energy, we would say, yes. Minister.
Who's been arrested for the,
yeah, the stealing for luggage, the, right?
Stealing luggage, et cetera. Yeah. But they were an expert, right? You know, like this is where the experts lie. And left or right, in certain issues, there's only because of the Washington consensus, which means one thing in foreign policy matters, a la Epstein friend Noam Chomsky. But there's also like the Washington consensus about domestic policy, and those things are kind of immovable. There's like, you know, you can move an inch this way, an inch that way.
Yeah.
Right. If RFK was in office, I think it would be probably good because he would have 20% difference. This change that people think they're going to get from Trump or RFK or anybody is going to be 20%. Yeah. I will tell you, if you get a Ron DeSantis, you're going to get 0% difference. That's I can tell you that is going to be the most swampy Washington thing you've ever seen in your life is that Ron DeSantis.
Well, I know that you want to get on to Ron de Sanctimonious, and I'm certainly going to. I'm going to give you a free hand.
I think he's so annoying.
Had a bit of a go at him and his implications with Alex McKay in last week's episode. But before we do, you had a great take on RFK's declining to criticize the cancelling of Roger Waters, or rather tweeting his in his defense and then deleting the tweet. That's what he's been challenged on there. A lot of the kind of a lot of our tanky friends, a lot of our COVID skeptic friends who were very excited about RFK for the same reasons certainly that I was, have kind of now dropped him and said, ah, that proves it, he's just another tool. Then the clip started circulating of him with this guy Rabbi Shmuley at pro-Israel rallies. I didn't clip it, but I'm just looking at RFK with his arm round this very conservative rabbi, very Zionist rabbi. The people who share RFK's politics, both on COVID and on foreign policy, are obviously disappointed to see this. I mean, very weak statement in that answer to the question, where he defends Israel's right to defend itself, blah blah blah, and then what about the Palestinians? Long pause. Oh, them. But your take is that the tankies and the COVID skeptics shouldn't be despondent. Give it to me.
I think at one point he followed me on Twitter, and I would say this. Rabbi Shmuley is just kind of this guy. He's like, I don't know how to explain this in Democratic politics, but he's just around, and people just they go and they do the thing and they go, right? And he's no more representative like of American Jewry than anybody, right? Like, but oh,
no. which is much more liberal and left wing than British Jewry.
Absolutely, absolutely. And no, I mean, what's going on in the UK? I can't even get into it, because it's like we really need to have like Daniel Besser on, or some other people who can talk more succinctly about like sort of like the Jewish experience in the US and foreign policy.
Mm-hmm. Check out our Tony Lem episode, listeners, for the British side.
I can say that like what you're experiencing is much more extreme than what we're experiencing, and we have more.
But what you said to me was that you weren't disappointed when you saw that clip from RFK, because it made you think he could win. And this isn't an ethical belief, but it's a political belief, right? That actually maybe you can. The entrance price for the COVID stuff and the entrance price for the anti-imperialist stuff is you just got to be a Zionist. You do that, and you can have whatever crazy politics you like.
I didn't say that. I'm going to be very honest with our listeners right now. I've been tiptoeing around what I said, and I knew what I said, but I was afraid to say it again. But what I will say is that I do think that his statement there, and like, I was like, oh, this guy's serious. Like in a way that like Marianne Williamson isn't serious, the way other people aren't serious. Yep. And I'm going to say this right off the bat. I do not take, I like Cornel West. I love Cornel West. I love him. I do not take the People's Party seriously. They're not on any ballots in any states. They have not run any candidates. They've been around for years. The Libertarian Party runs people. And they have it's a goofy organization, but they run people. And they win sometimes, occasionally. The Green Party is goofy, once again, in the U.S. It's a total goofball organization that I think is set up by the CIA to work against the left. That's my feeling. That's not. I think all the Green parties all over Europe, also CIA. That's my feeling. You can quote me on that.
Germany, but, for sure.
You can quote me on that. But what I will say is that I think the People's Party, they mean well. They're just really bad at it. And if you want to run, I think that he should just register as a Democrat and ran, because it just doesn't work that way. Like we do not have a multi-party system in the way that European countries do.
Let's just hear from Cornell as you bring him up.
Yeah.
In these bleak times, I have decided to run for truth and justice, which takes the form of running for president of the United States as a candidate for the People's Party. I enter in the quest for truth. I enter in the quest for justice. And the presidency is just one vehicle to pursue that truth and justice, what I've been trying to do all of my life.
Well, he's a hell of a guy. That's a fantastic introduction. But yeah, I mean, the People's Party are nowhere. I mean, it would be pretty cool to see him debating Biden and RFK and Marianne on the stage, were that to happen.
I'm just gonna quote. This is another name drop DC thing. I'm gonna quote my friend Ralph Nader, and that's to say he literally wrote a book about the fact that they will not allow third party candidates on the stage ever again. Not gonna happen.
No.
Not gonna happen. Your best bet, if you want to push people left, and like he obviously doesn't want to win. He's not gonna win. He's a brilliant guy. He knows he's not going to win.
Yeah.
So okay.
So you just want him on the stage on the Democratic?
I want him on the stage.
Yeah.
That'd be great. And the Democrats have said that they're not going to have debates. So this is what I would like is two or three people running, and it could be Biden who gets elected. Probably would be the case. Like I listen. I'm a Democrat. I'm tired. I'm resigned. Like I worked in the Obama campaign twice and I'm tired. And I'm a leftist. You have to understand, just for people listening, like because people often get these like little like idiosyncratic things about like where are your politics? I'm like, man, I'm just trying. You know, And with this situation, I'm just trying. And I'm like, listen, I would like Biden to the left. And like, I would like a president who's not 80. That would be great. As well. Just from like a reaction standpoint, like if you're thinking about it, like from a video game, like I'm just like, you know, maybe someone who's 60 would play it faster. You know, that's all I'm saying. You know, I'm not.
Okay. But I need to pin you down on this point about RFK. Despite the fact that he's running on a sort of Bernie economics, a much more radical foreign policy than Bernie ever contemplated.
His border stuff is wild.
The border stuff is more it's Trump intense. Than Trump. The critique of the CIA, which he's obviously got family credentials for, is the Peter Dale Scott via Tucker Carlson stuff. Yeah.
He
was on Steve Bannon. I've said before that I thought he was like 100 years old because I only knew him from his voice appearing on Steve Bannon. and he's got this is extraordinary kind of coalitional energy. And then, you know, he does the natural thing. Of course, somebody with that combination of politics is going to support Roger Waters. He gets the pushback from the, you know, right-wing Jewish organizations, and he deletes the tweet, and he denies it ever happens, and he acts like he doesn't give a shit about the Palestinians in a question. That seems unnatural to, you know, people in radical politics, but I found it very convincing when you suggested that this showed that he actually wanted to be in the running. So he just drops that Waters thing. He says, "You're not going to Corbyn me, motherfuckers. I'm going to prance around with the Israeli flag, and that's not going to be a problem for me." I find that very intriguing because, of course, the thing about anti-Semitism is, if you don't want to be accused of anti-Semitism, the key isn't don't be anti-Semitic. No, don't worry about that. You could be as anti-Semitic as you like, as long as you describe yourself as a Zionist and say that you're made up adherent of the state of Israel. It's much like the Catholic Church. You know, the genius of Catholicism is you can do whatever you like. You can sin as much as you like, as long as you believe in the infallibility of the Pope, and you'll be absolved by his representatives. Similarly, Israel basically hands out hall passes for anti-Semitism. You can be as anti-Semitic as you like. We saw that at the National Conservatism Conference. We see that all over the right, as long as you come home and say you're a Zionist. Meanwhile, if you're a well-meaning anti-racist on the left who's saying, oh, what's the right thing? I defend the Palestinians, but we shouldn't have so many tropes on the left. I need to police you on the left. You need the Owen Jones kind of position, talking about tropes all the time. But you're still going to be called an anti-Semite. If you're not a card-carrying Zionist, you're vulnerable to this this projection. And RFK has said, okay, that's the game. Yeah. Fuck it. You're not getting me on that.
Yeah. No, I think that's totally true. That's totally true. And I think, like, why not? Like, there is no benefit, like, from an electoral standpoint. And I hate to measure electoral standpoint versus values. It makes me feel very gross to do that. But it's a fact. And the United States is a very big country that wields a lot of power internationally. Too much. Right. Like, I'm an advocate of a multipolar world. I'll say that. Or a better Anglosphere world. You know, like, because I think that, like, there's discussions to be had about, like, who would orient the world better. Right. That's a very complicated and nuanced discussion that, like, we need to have. Right. About what the world is. I do not think that, like, China and Russia could recreate the world in a way that we would like for most people, but I do think that the Anglosphere and the Eurosphere is dealing with the world in a very shitty way that, like, we deserve what we get because of it, right? You know, like, that sucks. But let's not pretend it's an either-or proposition. There is a future where you could have the democracies of the world who are wealthy saying, hey, man, like, Nigeria is going to have, like, really nice nuclear power plants. That's great. Good for them. And we're going to help them. It doesn't have to be like this, like, we pry babies out of the arms of people in the third world. Like, it's just not the way it has to be. But what I would say is, like, RFK, and I think his focus on the border, is much more poignant with people in who are registered as Democrats in places like Pennsylvania, who may have voted for Trump twice, that people really understand. Yeah. And I think some of those Democrats thought Biden was old school in that way. And they voted for him for that purpose. And Biden, I look at, like, one, like, RFK is very funny to me because I think he kind of looks weird in the same way I look weird. So I always find him funny. Like, yes, you know, he's sort of like red. He's got a big forehead.
I know you identify with Joe Biden, like, David.
Yeah. But, like, Biden and RFK are, like, to most people, identical. Because people are looking
That's so interesting. That's so interesting. You know, because for the Twitter addicts liberals, that's not the case.
Americans don't think in specifics. They just don't. And I think that is something that makes English politics unintelligible to Americans. It makes American politics unintelligible to English people. And that's what they learned in the last 2 years of doing this podcast is, like, there are things that just, like, there's a gut vibe that Americans have about things that English people are constantly challenging their gut vibe, whereas Americans are, like, constantly validating their gut vibe. And that's right.
Yeah.
It's true. It's true. Mm-hmm.
Well, two things there. I think it's a very tough pill to swallow for the Bernie crowd and for the left that people voted for Biden not just to stop Trump and not because they believed that, you know, he was going to do what he has been doing to some extent, this infrastructure stuff. Yeah. But no, they voted for him because they believed he was still that, like, right-wing Democrat. Demon Absolutely. Of the past that he has been for his entire career until the Alzheimer's hit and he started believing in the state again.
People didn't vote for Trump for no reason. Like, that's the thing. Like, people don't get it. Like, they really bought in to Obama, and Obama went half ass. This is my political theory. And I'll write a book about this someday. But like, my theory is Obama going half ass on progress. Like, you cannot. It doesn't work that way. Like, yes. The thing is you're either doing it or you're not doing it. And that's like you're either married or you're not married, like, or you're dating or you're not dating. Like, I go back, like, everything is like that. You know, you love your kids, you don't love your kids. This is the way it is. Like, I don't want to be IO about everything, but I think some things are IO or one and zero. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a binary about progress. And if you're going halfway, then you just look regressive. So with a Biden character, like, you're like essentially saying, like, I'm pretending that this binary doesn't exist, right? And even with Trump, you're pretending the binary didn't exist. So Trump and Biden are not different in that way. Because they're like, hey, man, like, remember when things were, like, slightly better? Mm-hmm. We could do that, right?
Yeah.
And in both cases, people are like, that didn't happen. Right, so like it's, you know, they both ran on Make America Great Again.
Well, I think we've got to wrap it up at that point. We've covered the progressive end of the 2024 presidential spectrum, as well as a few other subjects. We'll get on with David to the right wing of the spectrum soon enough with the current dynamics of Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis. But in the meantime, I'm just going to say thanks to the people who support us and thanks to the people who listen to us. We'd love to have more of you, so please spread the word. And we'd love to have more financial support so that we can put a bit more into the show. So check us out at patreon.com/thepopularpod.
Thank you, guys.
Go ahead. I'll include this as well.
No. I was just going to say it's been a lovely show. I'm so happy to be back, and I look forward to many of these. I just want to say that you have to go back if you haven't listened recently. The last three or four episodes, James has done what I would say is some of the best archival work of the English left in recent times. And it's so, for me, I got to say, it's like, there's nobody doing what he's doing. And I love to add what I add to the show, but just for James's sake, go back, listen to those, think about them, and just really absorb what's going on there, because there are people talking about things that you just aren't going to hear anywhere else. We really appreciate your support. I hope you go to patreon.com/thepopularpod and support us. Thank you so much for all your help.